This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Ruhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Kenya's election season is still not over, as three petitions were filed with the Supreme Court before the deadline Monday evening. The petitions target all sides in the presidential election controversy: the Electoral Commission, opposition leader Raila Odinga, and President Uhuru Kenyatta.
That's Jill Craig reporting from Nairobi. We'll have full details on the story coming up.
Also, Liberia's Supreme Court has indefinitely postponed today's presidential runoff election, and Italian authorities are investigating the deaths of at least 23 trafficked Nigerian women on smugglers' boats in the Mediterranean Sea as possible victims of homicide.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story: Kenya's election season is still not over, as three petitions were filed with the Supreme Court before the deadline yesterday evening. The petitions target all sides in the presidential election controversy: the Electoral Commission, opposition leader Raila Odinga, and President Uhuru Kenyatta. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
Just when many Kenyans thought they had seen the end of the country's long election season, petitions were filed before a Monday night deadline to contest the process. Former lawmaker Harun Mwau filed a petition against the Electoral Commission, known as the IEBC, as well as its chairman and President Kenyatta. He is challenging the validity of the October 26th rerun presidential election, which he argues was held in violation of Supreme Court directions, the Constitution, and relevant electoral laws. An NGO called the Institute for Democratic Governance filed a petition against several officials in the opposition NASA coalition, including leader Raila Odinga, for engaging in what it called a carefully choreographed scheme to derail, undermine, and subvert the fresh election as announced by the Supreme Court. The IDG also accused the opposition of setting unreasonable demands for the Electoral Commission to meet. In addition, Halif Halifa and Njanjo Moi filed a petition against the IEBC, its chairman, Kenyatta, and the NASA coalition. Halifa is chairman of the Mombasa-based Muslims for Human Rights organization.
We filed this petition because there were a lot of irregularities in the last election and this election. When Supreme Court made a ruling and stated there were irregularities, because the procedures were not followed, and the Supreme Court was very categorical that elections is not an event, it's a process. Now, in this election, the process also were not followed. So it compelled us to go to court because we felt this election was not going to be free and fair.
Kenya's Supreme Court annulled the August presidential poll due to what it called irregularities and illegalities in the IEBC's transmission of results, and ordered the body to conduct fresh polls within 60 days. In the joint petition filed by Halifa and Njanjo Moi, Kenya's chairman of the International Commission of Jurists, they accused the IEBC of not conducting a fresh election per the Constitution and electoral laws, of failing to meet the general principle of universal suffrage, and of failing to hold elections free from violence and intimidation. However, Halifa says that he and Moy also want the opposition, listed as the fifth respondent, to explain why supporters disrupted polling in four opposition stronghold areas where the IEBC was unable to conduct the voting exercise.
NASA did not try to prevent its voters not to disrupt the voting. Okay? This is an area where we also want NASA to come in and explain, because this is a major thing, you see?
Kenya's Supreme Court has until November 14th to rule on these petitions. If election results are upheld, Kenyatta's inauguration will take place on November 28th. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Liberia's Supreme Court has indefinitely postponed today's presidential runoff election, ordering the Election Commission to resolve an opposition party's complaint for fraud from the first round of voting before the runoff can be held. The Chief Justice's decision throws Liberia's first democratic transition in decades into uncertainty. The two leading candidates, former football star George Weah and Vice President Joseph Boakai were set to participate in the runoff, but third-place finisher Charles Bromskian filed a legal challenge alleging widespread fraud. VOA's William Eagle talked to Monique Joan, who is covering the campaign from Monrovia.
Prince Johnson, the famous warlord who was the presidential candidate for the Movement for Democracy and Reconstruction, came out in support of George Weah after the first round results were announced. But the other major parties that were left out of the runoff, like the Alternative National Congress that's headed by Alexander Cummings, the All-Liberian Party headed by Benoni Yuri, and the Liberty Party, which is, of course, headed by Charles Bromskian, who has been leading the charge against the National Elections Commission, have all really coalesced around their complaints surrounding the irregularities on polling stations, not on the runoff party that they would support or should support. The Unity Party, which was listed in the runoff with Vice President Joseph Boakai running for president, he was courting groups initially, but even the UP joined in on those complaints and appeared alongside the Liberty Party at the hearings over the voting irregularities that were originally being held at the NEC before the complaints reached the Supreme Court.
Does it look likely that Boakai can make up the 10-point difference that he and Weah had in the first round?
I find it unlikely that Boakai would win at this point. And I think that this is exacerbated by the fact that the election process has been muddled by the complaints over voting irregularities. Weah is really popular, and I think that the plurality of people here are frustrated with the Unity Party because they're not impressed with what President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was able to accomplish. Even though she was able to sustain peace in the country after the war and is an icon internationally for women's achievement, she is still highly unpopular here because people are really dissatisfied with the quality of living and the fact that it hasn't progressed much since the wars. And yes, Boakai has gone to great lengths to distance himself from Sirleaf over the course of his campaign, even going as far as accusing her of meddling with the election results recently. But I don't think that will be enough to overpower Weah's popularity. In fact, the current divide in the Unity Party may even be hurting Boakai even more, because that divide could be hurting the party's credibility. Plus, there's the fact that Boakai hasn't really been able to focus on getting other parties, and therefore their partisans, to rally around him in the second round, because they've been so distracted by their condemnation of the NEC for the voting irregularities and the legal action that they've been taking as a result of it.
Monique, is there any concern that Weah's vice president is the wife of former warlord Charles Taylor? Some are concerned that Weah would be enacting Charles Taylor's agenda, although Weah has said he has his own.
Liberians' reception to the fact that Senator Jewel Taylor is Weah's running mate goes in mainly two different directions. Despite what any logical person from the outside looking in would think, many, if not most Liberians, ordinary Liberians, especially those who are less educated and far more socially disadvantaged, tend to say they would actually prefer if Charles Taylor came back into political power in the country because they felt they were better off in their day-to-day life while he was president. And this is obviously really surprising, if not baffling, considering Taylor played such a major role in devastating and destabilizing not only Liberia, but also its neighboring countries during the war. But because Taylor is still highly supported by many, they're also still highly receptive of Jewel Taylor. On the other hand, you've got other Liberians who are more educated, who are more privileged, and who would most likely tell you that they are concerned by the idea of having one of Charles Taylor's closest allies right beneath the presidential office. Taylor and his ex-wife still get along well with one another, and Charles Taylor is still in touch with Jewel Taylor and other supporters and Weah himself. You know, Taylor's agenda is largely constructed by limiting people's human rights, and it would make perfect sense why some are worried that he would try to channel his ideologies through his ex-wife and onto Weah.
That was Monique Joan in the Liberian capital. She was speaking to VOA's William Eagle.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
Amihis Wuhib, 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Kenya's election season is still not over as three petitions were filed with the Supreme Court. And Liberia's Supreme Court has indefinitely postponed today's presidential runoff election. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Italian authorities are investigating the deaths of at least 23 trafficked Nigerian women on smugglers' boats in the Mediterranean Sea as possible victims of homicide. The International Organization for Migration reports their bodies were found yesterday near the Italian port of Salerno. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration reports 402 migrants, most from West Africa, were rescued Sunday in four different operations along the central Mediterranean route. It says they, along with the remains of more than 20 women, were brought to the Italian city of Salerno. In one of the most dramatic operations, the IOM reports a sinking rubber dinghy was found in time to save the lives of 64 people, among the estimated 140 people on board. Among the bodies recovered were those of 23 Nigerian women and girls. The corpses of three other Nigerian women were retrieved from an inflatable boat in another operation. IOM spokesman Joel Millman tells VOA the 23 Nigerian women likely were victims of trafficking for sexual exploitation.
What's curious is that they are all from Nigeria as far as we know. They are women. A few of them are even underage women. And we don't have any information or any evidence to discuss now that indicates a homicide. It's just that the fact that they all come from one group, and it's a group that has been terribly victimized in sex trafficking for the last few years, lends suspicion that there could be a crime involved in their deaths, and not just accidental, which is also a crime.
Millman says the prefect of Salerno has decided to open an investigation to determine the circumstances of the deaths. He says the Italian authorities are performing autopsies on the bodies. Over the past 4 days, the IOM reports that rescue operations on the central Mediterranean route saved the lives of more than 2,560 migrants. It says 34 bodies were recovered, with an estimated 50 missing at sea. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. In another incident on the Mediterranean Sea, Italian authorities and another aid group, Sea-Watch, are looking into the death of a child and a missing person who were on another boat. Reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with me about the growing concern over the deaths at sea and the overall safety of migrants as they attempt the journey from North Africa to Europe.
We haven't had deaths reported for some time. And in a separate incident, Sea-Watch, one of the other NGOs, has reported at least another body, of a child that has died on another vessel and another body that's missing. There's great concern not only from the Italian authorities, but also from the NGOs and UNHCR. The UN organization representing refugees is saying that this tragedy, that this death of these women indicates the risks once again of crossing the Mediterranean, and they want to ensure that people are safe when they make this crossing, particularly because of the concerns about the torture, the rape and the violence that is still going on in the very unstable situation in Libya. Great concern from the NGOs, and that's why I think the prosecutors want to look at this case in particular and find out what happened.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
Scientists are calling for renewed efforts to develop a vaccine for one of the biggest causes of stillbirths and infant deaths worldwide. An estimated 1 in 5 pregnant women around the world carries group B Streptococcus bacteria. And most show no symptoms, but it can prove deadly for unborn and newborn babies, especially where traditional treatments such as antibiotics are unavailable. Henry Ridgewell reports.
Group B Streptococcus bacteria can be passed to an unborn baby in the womb or to newborns during labor. Left untreated, it can cause other serious infections, such as meningitis and septicemia. Out of about 410,000 cases every year, there are at least 147,000 preventable stillbirths and infant deaths globally. Professor Joy Lawn of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine co-led the research.
That's a very conservative estimate because, in fact, in most of Asia, there is very limited data around Group B strep or indeed any infectious causes of stillbirth.
The prevalence of the Group B strep infection varies globally, ranging from 11% in Eastern Asia to 35% in the Caribbean. The United States also has a relatively large number of infections, but the number of child deaths varies according to the treatment available.
It's not the same as, you know, many conditions that we look at around the world, which are only in poor countries. But if we look at the continent that has the biggest number of cases and particularly the biggest number of deaths, that's Africa.
At least 60 countries have a policy for antibiotic use in pregnancy to tackle infection, including the United States. But in Africa, health systems can rarely afford to screen or treat Group B strep. As well as the prohibitive cost, doctors say giving antibiotics to the estimated 21.7 million pregnant women carrying the infection may contribute to antimicrobial resistance, a major global health crisis. Again, Professor Lawn.
So this new evidence that we're publishing really pushes much more clearly the urgent need for a maternal vaccine to prevent Group B strep. We must be intentional from the start that vaccine's able to reach the poorest, and especially in Africa where the burden is highest.
At least four vaccines are in development, but none is expected to be licensed for at least 5 years. Until then, the researchers say health systems should continue to treat Group B strep using antibiotics where possible. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The program called Making Markets Matter is empowering young people in Africa to improve their farming skills. The effort is supported by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, the FAO, and the African Union. At a recent meeting in Nairobi, organizers said the 16-year-old program has benefited over 2,300 small enterprises from around the continent. From the Kenyan capital, Ruben Chama reports.
A recent meeting to assess the program brought together agribusiness entrepreneurs from across East, West, and Southern Africa. Christina Tihanti is from Market Matters, an independent international development consultancy that organized the five-day event.
We were really excited to have this opportunity to bring the program to East Africa because we've had lots of questions, requests every year. With this partnership with the FAO, this has allowed us to sort of make that jump, to come into a brand new, completely new place for us. The challenge actually to businesses that by the time you walk out from here, have three business deals in hand. So we want them to really connect with each other and maintain those connections. So far in the 17 years, we have trained over 2,300 businesses. I was going to say not all of them necessarily young, but one of the things we try to promote every year is women-owned businesses and bringing on young people who are entrepreneurs. We think that's important, but of course it's not the program is not exclusive to those groups.
Some say Africa has the potential to greatly enhance its food production. Abundant uncultivated arable land, a tropical climate that allows crops to flourish, a young labor force, and an expanding population that provides a readily available market for produce. But African governments are yet to harness these opportunities to ensure sustainable food security, says Alpha Bakabari from Guinea.
From a cereal businessman, what I'm looking for here is to settle some of the knowledges I had, confirm them, challenge my project with my peer agropreneurs, is to challenge my idea and see whether there is a possible network and a possible partnership. And you can see that. You can see the agro-business people here connecting among themselves and trying to build businesses, to have links. This is a major takeaway I'm having from this training program. But the management skills they are providing here, they are targeted specifically on agro-business.
Barca runs a small and medium-sized agribusiness enterprise. He says training by the FAO and AU project has provided him with new skills.
First will be a mind shift. Agriculture is not only a social activity, it is a business. So we could see agriculture generally in Africa as one of the key elements will be feeding the world in the next decades. There is a need of building champions within Africa. In order to do that, all the governments need to ease access to capital. They need to ease access to some of the infrastructure. They need to open up the market. Frontiers, specifically artificial frontiers within Africa, is killing agriculture. We need to open up. And we need, in terms of strategy, also to build hubs. We have 5 different hubs in Africa, so each hub can do something interesting and produces very well in an industrial way. And the last thing is to do sustainable agriculture.
The program trains the managers of small and medium enterprises to compete in an environment that favors transnationals and international business players. The initiative is quickly expanding its reach to East Africa to serve more entrepreneurs across the African continent. Stepanka Galatova is a senior representative from the UN FAO.
So at the moment, FAO is implementing a regional project on agribusiness development in collaboration with the African Union. A key component of that project is to train and build the capacity of these young entrepreneurs and build the capacities of small-scale domestic agribusinesses. I say domestic because, as you know, there's a lot of foreign investment coming into Africa, a lot of large-scale companies, multinational companies. Those are not the companies that we are targeting. We are targeting the domestic companies and promoting the development of the agricultural sector through agribusiness value addition and enabling these entrepreneurs to get market access, improve employment and income opportunities.
In addition, they are taught accounting skills and how to create networks between business and small farmers who want to better market their goods. They also work to create new markets across Africa. According to the World Bank, a 10% increase in agricultural productivity on the continent translates into a 7% reduction in poverty. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhibe in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day. Some things change, some remain the same. From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100, 0200, 1200 and 1300 UTC, GMT, right here on VOA Africa.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.